Welcome to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. I am Dr. John, the guide for your heroic journey towards greater health, success, and most importantly, happiness. And now, on with the show.
Hi, this is Dr. John, and I am thrilled to announce that Jory and I are opening up our retreat in beautiful Costa Rica from September 28th of 2024 to October 5th. Everyone wants fulfilling relationships. The hard part is love is not enough. So many factors can get in the way, preventing ongoing connection, intimacy, and aligned growth. All healthy relationships start within. But when we have unresolved stuff, it can easily interfere with those we are seeking to be closest with. Whether you're in a long-term committed partnership or are single and are looking for love, this retreat will guide you in the heroic journey of healing yourself so that you can be open and available to cultivate the fulfilling relationships you desire and deserve. To find out more, visit joreerose.com/retreats. That's joreerose.com/retreats. Hey, everybody. This is Dr. John back with the latest episode of the Evolved Caveman Podcast. And I am very excited to have with me today a very special guest. And let me read an intro from the book she just published. We have a happiness problem in our culture, and it's making many of us, well, unhappy. There's an unspoken myth that somehow we should be happy, at least much of the time, as if happiness is the holy grail or gold standard upon which we determine the value of our life. The problem is that when we don't feel happy, we often feel like we are falling short in some way, or that there's something wrong, or even that there's something wrong with us. And as I said, that's from the introduction of Dr. Beth Kirlin's new book, You Don't Have to Change Everything, 6 Ways to Shift Your Vantage Point, Stop Striving for Happy, and Find True Well-Being. And one of the most significant sources of suffering comes from our human tendency to avoid difficult emotions. We're not taught how to face these unpleasant, often daily inner experiences, so we tend to push them away, ignore them, or become unwittingly overwhelmed by them. So my guest today is Beth Kirlin, a clinical psychologist with 3 decades of experience, also a TEDx and public speaker, a mind-body coach, and an author of 3 award-winning books, Dancing on the Tightrope, Transcending the Habits of Your Mind and Awakening to Your Fullest Life, The Transformative Power of 10 Minutes, an 8-week guide to reducing stress and cultivating well-being, and this latest one. Beth blogs for Psychology Today, lives in the Boston area, and it is my pleasure to have her on the podcast today. Beth, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited for this conversation.
It's my pleasure. And you know, I'm a big fan of positive psychology, right? The scientific study of happiness for those that have been living under a rock for the last 20 years. But, and it's funny to me because your approach seems to fly in the face of positive psychology.
So I would argue that it doesn't really, but let me explain. So, you know, I talk about the words happiness and well-being in my book. And when I refer to happiness, there's really 2 kinds of happiness in psychology, although it's not talked about much. There's more of this hedonic happiness, and there's eudaimonic happiness. And hedonic happiness is really what I'm referring to, like from the excerpt that you read, this idea, at least where I grew up, which is here in the Northeast in the United States. I think there's a sense of striving for happiness that many of us, you know, from my culture, from messages in the media, from advertising, from social media, that we need to look or be or act or even feel, you know, a certain way all the time, that that is. And there's, and I want to say, happiness is a wonderful thing, and I wish it for all of us as much of the time as possible.
So do me a favor. Oh, sorry. Explain hedonic happiness.
Yeah. So for those I'm that sorry. Don't know. Right. So hedonic versus eudaimonic. So hedonic happiness is more of that pursuing pleasure. And so the way that it translates, at least in my experience, is it can be kind of more of that quick fix. It can be, it's dependent on us being in a certain mood. It's often dependent on external circumstances. You know, when X happens, then I'll be happy. And, you know, so we wait for that thing to happen, or maybe it happens, but then it's gone. And then, you know, there may be that, you know, what's left there.
I like to think of hedonic happiness as sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
There you go.
The pleasure. Okay. It's the pleasure of the senses. It's the pleasure of the experience.
Yes.
The problem with it is it only lasts as long as the pleasure lasts.
Right. It's fleeting.
Once that pleasure is done, it's gone.
It's fleeting. Yeah. And it's, again, it's, I'm not knocking that at all. I think that that's, you know, wonderful and for all of us to experience as much as possible. But when it does dissipate or disappear, you know, what then? Now, eudaimonic happiness is a little more what I'm talking about when I talk about well-being. And it's this deeper sense of meaning and purpose. And how do we, and it's something that I think of well-being as there for us, no matter what we're feeling or experiencing. So I might be feeling sad. I might be having a down day. I might be feeling angry or, you know, even dealing with grief or whatever. But even with any of those emotions or a whole range of emotions, my experience and the way that I'm talking about it is that well-being, it's possible for well-being to be present alongside of that. And I use this term of kind of drawing from this well of well-being or building this well of well-being that we can draw from, even when that, what, 50% of the time that we're not happy or 30% or 70% or whatever that is, when we're not in those happiness moments, what do we do then? And so this book really addresses that and how we can cultivate this well-being to sit alongside of all of these other emotions that we feel.
Thank you for the explanation, because I was teasing you a little bit in the opening, because to me, I think this is a huge part of a happier, thriving life, is kind of learning how to accept all of our emotions, understanding that all of the emotions are there for a purpose, except for shame. I'd love to get your read on that one. I can't figure out a positive purpose for that. But they're, if to look at them as messengers, right? And I think we add so much to our own suffering by, like, let's say I am a man. Let's say I get depressed as a man. Mm-hmm. And whereas I could just be depressed and sad and be like, okay, I'm depressed and sad. But instead, what we normally do is we pile on top of that. Oh, I shouldn't feel this way. We call ourselves names. We get angry at ourselves for feeling depressed. And that just makes everything more difficult and longer lasting.
Yeah, you hit it right on the head there. I think, and I talk about that a lot in my book, this idea of, you know, there's something referred to in Buddhist psychology, the second arrow of suffering, right? So we have the actual thing that is painful in our life that happens. And often there are these inevitable experiences that occur and normal human emotions that we just feel even a range of in the course of our week or lives. But, you know, this idea that if we feel, then add that narrative on top of that, you know, I shouldn't be feeling this way. What's wrong with me that I'm feeling this way? Judging ourselves, fighting against that, that really can increase our suffering by quite a lot.
And I love that Buddhist notion. I think of it as first dart, second dart. I guess you could go first arrow, second arrow, but first dart is pain. Second dart is suffering, and pain is inevitable. So we're going to experience pain in this lifetime, grief, loss, getting fired from a job, losing a relationship, you know, breakup. But there's that second dart, which we have some control over. We don't have control over the first dart, but the second dart, we have some control over, where we can kind of learn to minimize the suffering. And so one of the things that really strikes me about that second dart is having the self-awareness to know that you're doing it in the moment. That, you know, to have the awareness of thinking, oh my gosh, I'm shitting all over myself right now. Like, I shouldn't feel depressed. I shouldn't feel this way. I'm a man. I shouldn't feel sad. You know, whatever that second dart is, we all do it. And I think the self-awareness piece is really the foundation upon which we can build, I don't know where to go with that, a happier house, so to speak. Might be a bad metaphor, but.
Yes. Or I would say, you know, build your deep well of well-being from that awareness.
Okay. There you go. Thank you for that save.
So there we go. And you're, again, you're spot on. And I think in terms of, and a lot of what I write about in this book is how do we develop that kind of awareness? Because so easily we can get gripped by our emotions, or we're pushing them away, suppressing, avoiding. Often I think people swing back and forth between those two, myself included. Yeah. And so when we can learn to bring that kind of awareness to what's happening, that's really what I talk about in the book in terms of shifting our vantage point and being able to then be present to what is arising inside of us in a different kind of a way.
Well, I think that's a good segue into your first tool, the anchor view. If you wouldn't mind explaining that anchor view or finding stable ground.
Yeah. Yeah. So where to, I'm just trying to think where best to dive in here. So yeah, this idea that typically we're wired to seek what's pleasurable and avoid what's painful. And when we come up against our own painful emotions, again, there's that tendency to either push away or sometimes get swallowed up in it. What's happening on the level of the nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, which I talk about a bit in the book, is that we can go into these protected kind of survival protection circuits, if you will. Simplifying a little bit here, but this idea of our sympathetic nervous system that can get turned on when we're in the midst of more intense emotions, and we can, that can put us in a state of fight or flight, which can look like anger or irritability or frustration or worry or anxiety or fear, right? All these things. And that's part of our, these are all normal, you know, emotions that we all experience, part of our survival wiring that help to keep us safe in the face of saber-toothed tigers, that our bodies, you know, the people who survived had this biology that allowed them to fight the predator or to run away. And in more extreme cases, there was this shutdown mode, where it's kind of playing dead. And we don't do that quite so much in those terms, but we also, part of our protection circuitry can be some of that shutting down, withdrawing, you know, just feeling stuck, having a hard time mobilizing. I think we can all relate to any of these, you know, at different points in our life.
Yeah, it almost makes me think that is fight, flight, freeze, or flooded. But maybe the freeze is flooded.
Flooded, that can then
flooded emotionally.
Turn on that shutdown response.
Right, you just get paralyzed.
Yeah, the overwhelm.
And you're trying not to say anything.
Yeah.
Because you're angry or hurt, and that translates to stonewalling.
Yeah, yeah, and it's really interesting, not to get too sidetracked, but just to see these dynamics in relationships play out, where sometimes in a partner relationship, one person can go into a kind of fight response, and that can actually then trigger the other person's nervous system to go into a shutdown and maybe just close off, pull away, withdraw, disconnect completely. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's interesting. But getting back to where does the anchor view come in here? So as much as we have these protection circuits in circuitry, and they play a role, they're adaptive. There are times when we need those kinds of resources to either really mobilize, you know, to defend ourselves in certain situations, or to dart away from a car that's coming at us too quickly, or even to shut down, withdraw, to, you know, maybe protect ourselves at points, that all mm-hmm. of that can be adaptive. The problem is that we can get stuck there. And I know for myself, and I write a lot about what I, you know, kind of teach people what I need to learn myself and what I've been practicing. I know for myself, I have spent a lot of my life with my survival circuits turned on a little bit too high. And I think certainly in the culture that I grew up in and around me, I think that's not so uncommon. even just locked into that stress mode, right? So,
well, yeah, I look at stress as that sympathetic nervous system activation. Yes. And if you think about how many, the percentage of people that we deal with that just don't have access to the relaxation response, which is the other side of the coin. Mm-hmm. And I know I've been there at times in my life.
Yes. So when we have this energy that can either, you know, we have this internal disturbance, right? These emotions that are normal, that can give us information, that can sometimes help to guide us if we learn how to pay attention a certain way. But when we push them away or when we get flooded, then it becomes more difficult to work with them. So the anchor view is all about learning how to anchor our nervous system to bring more regulatory energy in. And I'll give it some examples to make that make sense to people. But when we can regulate what's happening on the level of the nervous system, it opens up, it puts us in a space where we have access to a whole different set of inner resources. Instead of our body mobilizing, heart rate going up, you know, our blood getting pushed to our fighting muscles to get ready to like tense up and run, we have access to stepping out of that tunnel vision and seeing a bigger perspective. We have access to greater problem solving. We, instead of often feeling isolated when we're in survival mode, because we're just kind of looking out for escape and, you know, that can disconnect us from others. When these other circuits are activated, our thriving circuits, this social engagement system, we feel more connected with other people. We have, so that connection is there to support us. We have access to more creativity, more courage, confidence, clarity, and I could go on. There's all of these resources that become available from a more regulated nervous system. So
yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, you go.
I was thinking that, you know, I think of it as that when we get stuck in that fight, flight, freeze system, the sympathetic nervous system, that not only does it limit our actions to fight, flight, freeze, it limits our thinking to fight, flight, freeze. So even our thinking is, you know, that son of a bitch, I'm going to make him pay, or I can't believe she just said that, or I got to get the hell out of here, or just being flooded and not wanting to say anything at all, or not even being able to think clearly. Absolutely. And so I like that idea that it limits our behaviors. It also limits our thought patterns.
And it's also intricately connected, you know, mind and body, thoughts, emotions, behaviors, they're all connected. So one thing affects the next. So when we're in that, let's say stuck in, and again, it's normal to move in and out of these states. I want to just sort of say that throughout the day. But when we get stuck there or gripped or overtaken, then it really becomes more challenging because we can't think clearly. We can't see a big picture. We have that tunnel vision where, you know, saying things to ourselves then that might be kind of extreme or catastrophic or irrational or not true. But they feel, those thoughts can feel very real in the moment. And yet when we can take a few minutes and help bring some regulating energy back into the nervous system, then it really shifts our looking out at the world. We see things from a different viewpoint. Things look different. The thoughts in our head sound different when we can regulate.
So what tips do you have to bring that regulating energy in?
Yeah.
So because that's key.
It is. And
it's huge.
Yeah. So and I'll just to say what you said earlier is really important, where we have to have the awareness that it's happening. So we can come back to more of that later. Yeah. But there's no one right way. I want to say that. And so I think it's each person understanding what's happening, you know, beneath the hood. I think we know our cars better and understand more about how our cars work than we do about how our autonomic nervous system works. And just a quick analogy with that, you know, we can think of part of these protection circuits is sort of like that accelerator jammed down and we're going 60 miles an hour and that's the only speed the car can go, you know, and the other part of our protection circuitry is where we have our emergency brake, let's say engaged, and we're trying to move forward, you know, and you're not going to get very far. And so when we can have access to all of the workings of the car, right, and be able to kind of tap on the brakes and press the accelerator and get this nice smooth ride as we need it, you know, then we have, we can get where we're going. We have access to, you know, kind of the full picture there. So going back to our bodies and understanding then how our bodies work, our breath is really so integral to our whole autonomic nervous system. And when we can, you know, and it's not something 100% for everybody, because some people find it uncomfortable to focus on the breathing. So I want to say that up front. But,
yeah, and I've also read that sexual trauma survivors often find it anxiety provoking to focus on breath because it's taking them into their bodies where they don't feel safe.
Exactly. Yeah. So that is an important factor. And that's where I say there's, it's not one right thing for anybody. I personally find the breath really, really helpful for me. And it's kind of understanding how to use it. So if we want to slow the system down, if we want to bring more calming energy into the system, it's actually really helpful to slow down the exhalation. And so just to let, because a lot of people, times when you say take a deep breath, a lot of people do this and kind of suck in a lot of air. And that actually gets that sympathetic system revved up. It's like pressing harder on the gas pedal, brings in more energy. And so focusing on the inhalation is helpful if we're feeling really sluggish or low, and then bringing in more of that inhalation. But when we're feeling anxious or fearful or stressed or, you know, irritable like that, then really learning how to just slow down our exhalation and make it longer than the inhalation. And I find like pursing one's lips, but breathing out kind of through a straw. So you let the breath come in naturally through your nose, and then kind of like a, just a really slow, it actually slows the heart down. There's a connection with this vagus nerve and and the nodes on the heart. And it, so just this slow breathing slows the heart rhythm down, and it sends messages to the nervous system to say, hey, everything's safe enough here to kind of bring things down a notch.
So, so that, let me just clarify if I could. So what you're saying is that if I want to get more energized, I focus on a longer inhalation. I inhale longer. And I think I can even hyperventilate, like I can quicken my breathing. I do that before lifts sometimes at the gym. And if I want to calm myself, I'm going to focus on a longer, slower exhalation. And that helps me bring my system down, relaxing.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. The other research I've seen recently, which I really like, is if you want to downregulate the system or relax yourself, a deep, long sigh. Like sighing when you exhale. I really like, and I've been playing around with that, and I'll do it. And then, you know, my daughter will say, are you okay? Is something the matter with you? I'm like, I'm just working on my breathing.
No, I love that. The sigh is great because it activates that parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah.
It's just another way of, kind of letting everything release. But it's interesting because really when we begin to pay attention to our posture, and our breath and our muscle tension, those three things are all things that we can kind of dial into and up, down where we need based on what's going on. And so if you just do an experiment, or maybe the people listening kind of can, might do a quick experiment where if you hunch over, just really like slump over and tighten all your muscles, and you might notice it's very hard to breathe when you're doing that. And just think about something typical, my, you know, stressor in your week, and just say, I'm so stressed. And just notice how that feels and what happens, right? And then let that go, sit upright, and just allow as much as you can your muscles to just soften, kind of like an ice cube melting in hot water. And you might just notice the breath, and you might extend that exhalation, or take just a deeper breath, just slowing down your breathing a little bit. And think of that same stressful situation, and even try to say to yourself, you know, I'm so stressed. And just notice, like, what, how does it feel different? What looks different just from those even shifts of cues in the body.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it's a noticeable difference quickly in my muscle tension and within my physiology. The other thing I will ask clients to do is be aware of the pace with which they are speaking, the pace with which they are moving. Because I find when I get stressed, or if I feel behind, if I feel amped up and energized, I will walk more quickly, I will move more quickly, I will speak more quickly. And those are all things that are under my control if I want to bring my energy down and relax more.
Yes, absolutely. Again, spot on. And I think mindful movement and intentional movement and slowing down our movements can again help to interrupt that, especially sort of more of our reactive stress response, and give us that little pause in which we can then think a bit more clearly about how do I want to proceed? What's needed here? What's happening? Maybe we need to attend to something that our emotions are, you know, telling us. But maybe there's some wise and skillful action that we can take that's not going to be available to us if we're in that revved up or shut down state.
So Beth, I love what you're saying so far, and I want to get to a couple more of these big six that you've identified. Tell us about the second one, the child view.
Yeah, so we were talking about the importance of awareness, right? So I like to think of it this way. We can't change what we don't see. And so if you're walking around in a dark room and, you know, pitch black, you're going to be tripping over things, bumping into things and so forth. There's obstacles in the room. But if somebody hands you a flashlight, then all of a sudden that room becomes illuminated. The obstacles are still there, but you can navigate with greater ease. So I think of this metaphor of the flashlight of really a metaphor for mindful awareness. And how do we cultivate that? And this child view, and in some ways, they're not absolutely sequential, but I think it's helpful, at least in my mind, I think of them to kind of, you know, grab that anchor when we're first, you know, whatever's going on inside, that inner turbulence. Kind of think of an anchor of a boat that holds that big boat stable in the midst of the storm. And then once things are a bit more regulated in there, we can start to bring some curiosity to what's happening. And so that is, curiosity is, I think, an essential quality of mindful awareness. And I call it the child view, because if you've ever watched a little child, you know, like a baby, a very small child, the way that they are so fascinated by, even you give them a crinkly piece of paper or, you know, any object, that they will just explore with this kind of curiosity. They haven't developed such strong likes and dislikes yet. They don't have judgments. They don't have a whole narrative about what that object means or doesn't mean to them. And so they'll just pick it up and they'll be like, wow, you know, just turn it around, look at it and explore it with this kind of openness. And so the child view is all about helping to cultivate that and other childlike qualities of friendliness, playfulness, humor, some of that as well. And how all of those qualities can help us when we are kind of meet and greet some of these more unpleasant or difficult emotions that might arise.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you. I'm a big fan of curiosity. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in like couples work, right? I mean, if we can be more curious and less judgmental about who our partner is and what they're doing, it makes a lot of work much easier. And instead we get so caught up in the narrative that we're attached to about who our partner is and what they're doing. It can really make people dig in their heels. So let me ask you this. How do you conceive of curiosity? How do you activate curiosity more so? I mean, in addition to conceiving of yourself as a young child or even telling yourself that I'm an intensely curious person, but do you see curiosity as an emotion that you wait for? Is it an attitude that you develop?
It's something I think we can practice. And it's this, it has this piece of it of turning towards, right? Because earlier in the conversation, we were talking about how innately we tend to turn away from difficult emotions because they're unpleasant and we're wired that way. And so it's doing something a little bit counterintuitive, it's that turning towards enough to notice. But there's a little exercise that I have in the book, and I like to try to practice this one a lot myself. That's I call stop, drop, and get curious. And so when you notice, you know, something, some inner turbulence, I mean, you could use it anytime. And actually it's a nice practice when things are, when there's calm waters too. But it's that intention to stop, to hit the pause button for a moment and to really drop into the body, because we often can live in our heads so much of the time or be disconnected from all of this information that's happening in our bodies. And so the drop is to really drop in and just kind of turn towards as if you had a flashlight and you're kind of looking around in there, like what's, or, you know, I'm looking under the hood, like what's going on? I hear a funny noise. Let me open up this hood and take a peek around here. And so it's beginning to then notice, okay, what physical sensations are present? Let me give a concrete example. When I am, I'm thinking of a lot of frustrating situations for me, but we'll use the one of being on hold with an insurance company for, you know, a half hour.
Oh, that's a good one.
Not getting the issue resolved, something like that, right? Yeah. So if I can remember to stop, you know, kind of hit the pause button, because I can get pretty revved up and frustrated and irritated, and then to drop inward and really notice. So I just say, oh wow, I can notice that my whole chest is tightening up. My muscles are clenching. My breath just became really shallow. You know, I can notice that I'm starting to have some not so nice thoughts going on in my mind right now. I can notice that, you know, I can feel my body revving up as if I'm preparing to fight a tiger or something like that. If I can drop in enough to notice that and just really get curious about that, it gives a lot more choice. Then all of a sudden I can recognize, like, oh wow, okay, this would be really helpful if I was had an external physical threat that I was trying to resolve in this moment. But this reaction here that's happening right now in my body is probably not the most helpful that's going to move me towards well-being in this moment. And so it's that interruption and curiosity to then be able to say, you know, what else might be helpful here, or what other resources could I draw on to help me?
Yeah. And in terms of self-awareness there, I really like the idea that in that example, bureaucracy is a universal anger trigger. So being caught up in bureaucracy, like the phone tree at the insurance company or your health insurance company or whatever, that triggers anger for almost everybody. And so to be aware of it, oh yeah, there's that bureaucracy anger trigger. Yeah. Well, you know, is it going to help me to be angry in this situation? Mm-hmm. And does the person who's picking up the phone really deserve my wrath? Because mm-hmm. they didn't cause the problem. They're just kind of an innocent cog in the wheel.
Yeah. Yeah. There's suddenly more choice there with that kind of curious awareness. When you were saying that, it just reminded me too, I wrote this book during the pandemic, and this idea of curiosity was really helpful for me with that too, because I think we all, or most all of us, felt, especially at the beginning, there was a lot of fear, you know, with all that uncertainty and the lockdowns and all of this. But me just remembering, whether it was waking up in the middle of the night, you know, in a bit of a kind of panicky mode, or just walking around in this heightened state of stress, when I could remember to look inward and just get curious about, oh, let me notice, like, what's happened? What is my body doing right now? What's happening emotionally? Where are my thoughts at? I could remind myself, this is my body trying to protect me. And this is, you know, an adaptive, innate response. And yet it's not actually helping me feel more safe in this moment. And me walking around carrying all that stress is probably not going to serve my well-being. So what else can I do? And then there's that, you know, being able to step back and look at how else can I, you know, move towards well-being.
Yeah, I'll often talk back to my body in those situations where, you know, my body's giving me this surge of energy and in the form of, you know, anxiety or stress or fear even. Mm-hmm. And that if I look at it as a messenger or my body trying to help me out, that's just my body giving me energy to prepare me for a challenge.
I love that. Yes.
The problem is that my body in the past has been really good at giving me too much energy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you, the more energy you have in those situations, the more it can lead to paralysis or psychological paralysis or things like panic attacks or high anxiety. And so I've learned over the years to talk back to my body and say, hey, look, thank you so much for the energy. I appreciate your intent to help me out with this challenge. You might have overshot the mark a little bit. You know, I didn't really need a 10 on the energy scale to deal with the phone call with the insurance company. Let me work on, you know, kind of bringing myself down, relaxing myself a little bit. Again, thank you for the help. Next time, maybe a 6. That would be helpful.
Yeah, I love that. You know, when we have that awareness, we can even learn how to kind of sometimes touch the dial it down to match what's happening. Sometimes we can do that. Sometimes we can't, but that's okay.
Yeah. But
I think that is really helpful, what you shared. I like to say to myself, sometimes, you know, it's just, okay, let me look around. No tigers chasing me right now. Okay. Thank you, survival circuits. Thank you, protection circuits for trying to, you know, keep me safe in this moment. And, you know, what else is also here? And importantly though, I do want to emphasize that a lot of what I talk about is really learning how to meet and greet and accept and embrace whatever is here, whatever we're feeling. And that it's not, because I think, you know, going back to get earlier in a conversation, we can judge our own emotions. We can feel like I shouldn't be feeling this way, or what's wrong with me that I'm feeling this. And instead to really be able to, like you said, kind of think about all of our emotions are just giving us information. Mm-hmm. And they're there for a reason. And can we hold the space and just allow whatever's there to be there? And then how do we work with it?
And one of the phrases which I stole from mindfulness, I believe, is allow whatever's arising to arise without judgment.
Yes.
And the without judgment piece takes several years of practice. And even then, you're not perfect at it. Mm-hmm. But going back to that idea of first dart, second dart.
Yes.
So thank you for that explanation. I greatly appreciate it. And would you tell the listener now about that third pillar, the audience view, learning to zoom out?
Yeah. So again, there can be a little bit of a sequence here. And this is really another aspect of mindfulness, that ability to have the awareness to notice what's happening without being swallowed up in it, caught in it, or disconnected from it. Mm-hmm. And this is a skill. It definitely takes practice. I'm working on it all the time. But I think of the audience view because I talk about, my brain thinks in metaphors a lot. So this idea that we often think of ourselves, or we don't think of ourselves, we're like the actors on the stage, you know, we're caught in the drama of what's happening. But imagine that in fact, we were really the self that's sitting in the audience that could observe the actors on stage. That's a very different vantage point, right? From the audience view, you could say, oh yeah, wow, I noticed that Beth is getting really frustrated right now. And I can notice that, you know, this is happening and she's, you know, getting pulled towards this behavior or whatever. But all of that, if I can see that from the audience, then it creates a little bit of space and a little bit of distance in which, again, there's more opportunity for choice to arise. Importantly, and I share a little story in the book, when my son was very little and was performing, he was in preschool and had a little performance going on. And he did something that was absolutely endearing and the audience burst out laughing, you know, but really like with him, but he didn't know that and he was distraught. And so to his mind, you know, on stage there, it was like he was just overtaken. But for me in the audience, there was, I didn't take on his emotions, but I could feel, you know, what he was feeling, but I also wasn't fused with that. I could remain just from my perspective and send care to him. And so there's a caring quality of sitting in the audience. You know, it's not just dispassionate. It's not disconnected with no heart in there. But I think that with mindfulness, that if we can really learn to turn towards and notice our experiences with the quality of staying connected to our heart in some way, that there's some care about what's happening on stage, but we're not swallowed up. And if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Let me paraphrase that and see if it makes sense.
Yeah.
So it seems to me you're talking about our innate ability almost to fuse with our thoughts and feelings. Like we become, yes. I, John, if I'm not skilled at this, become fused with my anger, with my stress, with my sadness, with my guilt. Yes. And the importance of psychological distance, stepping out and zooming out, having perspective from those emotions, from those thoughts, and realizing that you are separate from them. And is that correct so far?
Yeah, it's absolutely. We take our thoughts as facts so much of the time when they're, you know, especially in those moments where there's more difficult emotions present as well. And we can absolutely be fused with that and identify with our emotions and our thoughts. And even in our language, and it's different in different cultures. There's differences, there's nuances, but in the English language, it's kind of, you know, I'm so angry. I'm so, you know, anxious that I am. Mm-hmm. And so one of the exercises that I talk about in the book is really adding this phrase of, I notice that. And just when we add that languaging, instead of, you know, I'm so angry, but I notice that I'm experiencing a lot of anger in my body right now. Mm-hmm. And just taking those words in or playing with them in your own mind, or, you know, I'm so anxious versus I notice that there's, you know, anxiety and stress chemicals flooding through my body right now. Or even, you know, I'm so stupid versus I notice that I'm having the thought that I'm so stupid.
And again, psychological distance. Yeah. And one of the best ways I've learned to create more psychological distance, because we've known for years that psychological distance from that thought stream is critical to our mental health. And I was interviewing Ethan Cross a while back, and he was sharing that the research shows that the easiest way, the way with the least amount of cognitive load, least amount of effort to gain psychological distance in the moment is to speak to yourself in the second or third person, which is fascinating to me because if you think of, when I think of when I'm flooded, when I'm getting really angry or sad or guilty or whatever it is, I'm thinking in first person. Oh my God, I can't take this anymore. I can't believe I did that. Oh my gosh, I, me. And far better, I usually do third person, so I'll switch to John. John, take a deep breath, relax. You're gonna be fine. It's not that big a deal. You're experiencing a little bit of anger right now. That's normal. And so you can hear how it's funny. They're just thoughts, but they have these emotional tones to them.
Absolutely.
And it gives you that instant perspective to the more you can practice that tool.
Absolutely. And that's funny. Actually, I mentioned that in the book as well. You know, this idea of the third person and talking to ourselves in third person, because I think it's such a simple thing. It's something we can do wherever we are. We just have to remember to use it or try it. But in doing so, it really can take a difficult situation and just bring perhaps even a tiny, tiny bit of ease or space in there in which we can begin to then see things from a slightly different perspective.
Yeah. And I also like the idea of speaking to the inner child in you, kind of an IFS or internal family systems approach of, you know, speaking to that hurt, scared, feeling unsafe 5-year-old in you. Mm-hmm. You know, John, you're safe. You're going to be fine. And I'll tell him to go back to sleep. I'll be like, go take a nap. I got this under control. You're okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that actually kind of touches into the compassionate parent view.
Perfect
point. Which is really very much about that, because when we come up against difficult emotions, most often we think about, let me phrase it this way. Think about three different parents in response to a child who's in distress, child who's something disappointing happened and they're having a bit of a meltdown or something. And that first parent who completely ignores the kid. So that child is just left on their own, just kind of floundering in their own distress. The second parent who, you know, is more harsh with the kid. Hey, cut it out. You know, let's, you know, cut out that crying right now and let's see a smile, or I don't want to hear your whining or something like that. The judgment, right?
Yeah.
And the third parent who maybe sits next to that child, maybe puts an arm around the child and just kind of says, wow, yeah, that I see how disappointed you are. That's understandable, you know, and I'm here with you. And we often treat our own emotions, our own inner emotions, like that first parent or the second parent. Either what's wrong with me that I'm feeling this way, or maybe we just completely disconnect from ourselves. And we very rarely, at least in my experience, you know, in working with people, and certainly not something that came naturally to me, was more of that compassionate parent. And I use that lightly, loosely. You don't have to have had, many people have not had experiences of a compassionate parent. One could substitute, you know, a sense of being with a compassionate friend or just a compassionate presence. But I love your third person, you know, that idea of talking to yourself in that third person, or even talking to the hurt part of yourself in that third person voice, begins to really shift our relationship with ourselves, with what's happening, that all of a sudden we're there for ourselves in a way that we often are not. And that begins to change everything.
It's interesting. Just a personal aside, I realized a few years ago in my relationship with my fiance that when we would have disagreements, at times I would go to shame. Like I would get flooded and I would go to this place of shame where I would think things like, I'm just not good at this relationship thing, or she'd be better off without me, which is all about disconnection due to worthiness or lack of worthiness.
Yeah.
And so I had to work on speaking to that young John and tell him, hey, look, you're safe, you're secure, you're worthy, you're loved, like you're going to be okay. And why don't you let me handle these disagreements, the wise adult me, and we'll promote you to a new role, consigliere, or, you know, trusted listener, trusted advisor. But I think, you know, because it's hard to get to those beliefs that happen, those deep-seated beliefs that happen when we're very young, before we even had, you know, I think any sort of ability to defend ourselves against what was coming in, usually from our parents or, you know, other adults.
Yeah. I mean, it's so beautiful what you said and how you worked with that within yourself, you know, and just for others to hear that. And I do think that so many people have experienced, you know, sometimes like big T trauma for sure, and sometimes just more little T traumas, and just the, you know, this human life and the challenges of imperfect parents and maybe, you know, kids who are mean, and these sorts of early experiences can really stick with us. And that, you know, when those memories come up, it can really activate our protection circuits. Are, you know, sometimes, like you said, even the shutting down or the shame, to me feels like part of that protection shutdown.
Yeah.
Response.
Well, and it's interesting to me because, you know, I've been doing a lot of relationship couples work lately, and I think it's fascinating to me. And I did the same thing, where you get into a disagreement with your partner and you have no idea that this really has very little to do with your partner and with the present. And it's all about, you know, a prior relationship or your early childhood.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so
in the moment, anyways, you know, it's only, you know, 3-5% of the time. It's pretty limited.
Right.
But when it comes up, it's pretty profound.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think all of these tools can be helpful to be able to step back so that we can begin to differentiate what is old and what is actually present moment. It, you know, working with some of those old, you know, younger, how do I say it? Older, younger, meaning, you know, the inner child hurt parts of us. That some of that can definitely be a lot of work. I know for myself, you know, and I speak openly that I've spent many years with many different therapists over the years, and you know, it was really quite transformative experience. But learning, you know, how do we be with some of those hurt parts of ourselves? But I think on just a more general level, this idea of taking the compassionate parent view, being able to find little ways even of dipping our toe into this as we go through our typical week and the typical, you know, rise and fall of different emotions that come up, can be helpful because it offers us a kind of support to be present with ourselves in a way that we otherwise might not be.
Yeah, very well said. And let's get to one more tool before we wrap up here. Can you go over the mirror view?
Yeah, the mirror view. So the mirror view in some way, well, so here's a, you know, positive psychology piece for you for sure. I had a mentor in graduate school on my internship, and this mirror view somewhat came out of that, you know, and all the years following that. But so Dr. Robert Brooks, I was training at McLean Hospital at the time in Boston, and he really taught me and, you know, all of the people who he worked with this idea that instead of just kind of focusing on what's wrong and trying to fix it, we can focus on what's right and trying to strengthen it. And he used a term of that we all have these islands of competence within ourselves, but we often don't see them. And so when we can help, you know, as a therapist in the training, it was about helping others find and view their islands of competence and really building upon those. But in the book, this idea of the mirror view is really when we often look in the mirror, metaphorically and sometimes in reality, we often see our you know, shortcomings, right? The things we don't like about ourselves, the imperfections, all of that. And we can get, you know, into a more self-critical mode, that kind of thing. But instead, this idea of how about looking in the mirror, but this mirror that really reflects back our strengths, the things that are working for us, the things that we're doing well, maybe qualities that we've already developed or experienced in certain parts of our life that we can learn how to strengthen and to take into other areas of our life. So it's really all about working from strength and accepting our imperfections. I think that's an important part, and and certainly, I think, you know, again, a really important theme of accepting all of our emotions as just part of our common humanity. But within that, what can we dial into? How do we dial up some of these inner qualities that can really be supportive for us, and ones that maybe we overlook, we tend to dismiss or not pay attention to?
Yeah. And one of the classic examples of that is, you know, I talk to a lot of clients that consider themselves procrastinators, and procrastination has a negative connotation to it. And no one wants to be a procrastinator. And yet what we find is that procrastinators can actually come up with better ideas. They generate more creative ideas because they sit on the task longer and think about it more deeply. Mm-hmm. And I like this reframe from a positive psychology perspective of switching procrastinator to percolator, where percolator needs to sit on the idea and stew on it before they come up with the ideas that they can go ahead and they can use to go ahead and complete the task. What's more, I think, you know, they need the anxiety to rise to a certain point, kind of like a fire under your rear end, to motivate you to get going. And that's just it's a stylistic difference. It's not right or wrong.
Yeah, I love that. I love the reframe of that, and really being able to, and somebody normally maybe then wouldn't see that as see any strength in there, but you just turned it around for them. And so now they're able to look at themselves in a totally different way. And that's very much what the mirror view is really about. It's about being able to find that for ourselves and hold it up for others too.
Well, Beth, I love the book. I love what you're doing here. I think the work is fantastic. So in wrapping up, let me ask you this. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have?
Interesting question. I guess nothing in particular that jumps out. I would just maybe say to speak to the title in that, you know, the title is You Don't Have to Change Everything. And then 6 Ways to Shift Your Vantage Point, Stop Striving for Happy and Find True Well-Being. But this idea that I think change, we often think that, you know, we start from a framework of something wrong, something missing, something broken, that kind of thing. And when we can really learn to meet and greet ourselves where we are and accept all of our emotions and to learn how to be with our emotions in a way that we're not swallowed up by them, but we're not dismissing them. And we can kind of be that compassionate friend or compassionate parent, you know, for our own inner hurts. And we can see our own strengths and all of these things. And just in this bigger frame of acceptance of all of this being part of our common humanity, what I've found as a therapist over all these years is that's where real change happens, is beginning with just that accepting ourselves and kind of embracing all of it.
You know? Yeah, I think that radical acceptance of self and all your imperfection really allows you the freedom and the flexibility to look at what's actually going on and then have more bandwidth or room to change it.
Yeah.
It gets you out of that resistance cycle where you're resisting parts of who you are, parts of which you don't like, which we all have.
Yeah. And when we can access all those inner resources from a more regulated nervous system, and when we're more compassionate with ourselves, you know, all these resources become available that are already there. So that's another reason we're not changing. They're there. It's a matter of discovering that so we can then call upon those more frequently to help move in the direction of well-being.
Thank you very much. And so the book again is You Don't Have to Change Everything. And
you don't have to change everything.
Thank you. You don't have to change everything. And if you'd like to find out more about Dr. Beth Kurland, her site is bethkurland.com, BethKurland.com. And I'm sure that the book is available everywhere. Is that correct?
It is. It should be. Yeah. Yep. I think all the major sites. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me here today. I thought it was a fantastic conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. It was absolutely my pleasure.
And that's it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. If you like this episode, please remember to like, rate, review, and share with your friends. If you didn't like it, you don't have to do a damn thing. Thanks so much. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.